you like music? Do you read books too? Then WGXC and me, local noisemaker and music writer Sal Cataldi, have a show for you. It's called Reading is Funkdamental. Every month we interview the authors of the greatest books ever written about music across all genres and eras, from Sly Stone to Coltrane, Black Sabbath to Bach, ambient to easy listening. So make a date to join us the second Wednesday of every month at 10 a.m. for Reading is Funkdamental.
Did you know that Wave Farm's WGXC 90.7 FM has its own app? The Wave Farm radio app, available for both iOS and Android, allows users to listen to live audio from any of the Wave Farm web streams, including WGXC 90.7 FM, Standing Wave Radio, the installations in the Wave Farm Art Park, and other partner streams. And you can also find us on the Bloomberg Connects app, where you can explore the Wave Farm Art Park installations and the Pomotsitok Wak Kulistok, an indigenous sound walk. Plan your visit and learn more about what Wave Farm has to offer at wavefarm.org.
Wave Farm's WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Brenton Leinug of Saugerties, New York. WGXC supporters care deeply about creative community radio. Their generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You, too, can become a monthly supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
Take your Wellingtons off, children, and Mammy will tell you a pleasant story.
Good evening. This is Kevin Factor, and you're listening to Foraging Ahead. And tonight on Foraging Ahead, we're going to forage into literacy. And my guest tonight is Larissa Phillips. Larissa is the founder and director of the Volunteer Literacy Project, a nonprofit organization that trains volunteers to teach reading to adults. And since discovering 15 years ago that structured phonics was almost non-existent in the adult ed world, she has worked to offer evidence-backed methods of teaching reading to adults who can't read. I think I might need a little help there. She is author of City Stories, Townsend Press, in 2018, a collection of decodable stories for teen and adult beginning readers, as well as the author of Rex Runs Off, a series of decodable chapter books for older elementary children who are struggling readers. All of these books were written to respond to the tremendous need for beginning reading materials at the upper elementary, teen, and adult levels. And when she's not training volunteers or teaching reading to adults, Larissa lives on a farm in Greene County with ponies, sheep, and chickens. And I might also add, Larissa is a fine storyteller who won a story slam a couple years ago.
Before
the pandemic. Yeah. So welcome, Larissa.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
So there's got so much to get into.
Yeah.
Could you tell me how you got interested or into literacy? Were you a trained teacher, or how did you come to this or see this need and then try and fill it?
Yeah. I had no interest or designs on going into education at all. I was an editor and a writer in an industry that was slowly shutting, shutting all its doors. And I got a job, sort of randomly got a job running a GED program. And it worked for, it was part-time. It worked for me with having little kids and at home. And I worked two long days, and it was great. And then I started getting people who couldn't read, who would come in and you know, they, there was no hope of them getting even studying for the GED. They literally couldn't read. And I was like, oh, cool, no problem. I can help you guys. You know, sure, I know how to read, so it's probably easy to teach reading, mm-hmm. right? Which, and then I very quickly found out it's not easy to teach reading. It's not intuitive, particularly with people who have gone decades without being able to learn to read. You know, you're dealing with kind of the most remedial population and the most dyslexic or the most disadvantaged. And so then I started asking around, and I found out that nobody in the adult ed world knew how to teach reading.
Really?
Yeah. Like, literally. Like, the things that I heard were so shocking. Like, I mean, from directors of foundations, from education directors, from teachers, I heard again and again things like, you know, it's never really been proven you can teach them to read. I don't think anyone really knows how to do that. Are they retarded?
Whoa.
Yeah, like really kind of ignorant and uneducated responses. So I just kept searching. And meanwhile, and this is kind of the thing that is sort of the most important to me, is that the students never left. So these students who had come, and they kept coming, and pretty soon I had like five or six or seven, and they just kept coming, and they wouldn't leave.
What do you mean they wouldn't leave?
They wouldn't leave my program. Like, they kept hanging out. They kept coming, uh-huh. and they would just sit patiently, like waiting for me to figure this out. And I found myself really, first of all, I would chat with them, so I got to know them, and I really liked them. And I found myself really inspired by them. And like their persistence and their just absolute dedication to the idea that they needed to learn how to read was really moving to me. Like, it wasn't something I could walk away from.
Huh.
So I kept looking. I finally discovered in the children's ed world, I discovered how to teach reading. And I got certified, and I brought the program back to my program. And I had this big problem of how to teach volunteers how to teach reading. And that's been kind of like my mountain to climb ever since then.
Mm-hmm. So what's the difference between teaching adults how to read and teaching children how to read?
Well, there's a lot of evidence at this point about, there's been so many studies and so much research done on how to teach reading, and basically everybody learns how to read in the same way. Your brain is going through the same process of connecting sounds and symbols, putting it together. Whether you are, you know, learned to read at 3 years old and you figured it out, or whether you are dyslexic and had to get really intensive tutoring or anything in between, we all learn how to read the same way. But adults, I think there are some extra problems, extra struggles, because they've oddly, almost like counterintuitively, because they've been living in the world of print for decades.
Mm-hmm.
So they have experiences with print, and they've come up with strategies that are often not good strategies.
Huh.
Yeah.
I mean, can I just say, like, when I think about it, and I work with young people as well, not young as well, but I work with young people, that learning how to read is unbelievably difficult.
Yeah.
I mean, it is so amazing that human beings have figured out this system to transmit language and thought.
I totally agree. Yeah.
With these printed symbols, and of all the languages, like English, of all the phonetic languages anyway, English is really one of the most difficult ones.
It is difficult. They call it, it's opaque.
Opaque.
It's opaque
kind.
Language. Yeah, exactly.
That is
as opposed to transparent. Like, Italian's very transparent.
Yeah, yeah.
And everything is
as
just
are
right
Italians.
There.
I mean, it's...
Yeah, yeah.
I'm sorry. No, I didn't mean to do it. But.
And it's largely... I mean, one of the main reasons is because Italian comes... Like, 95% of Italian words come directly from Latin.
Yeah.
It has one source. And English has multiple sources. Yeah. And I like to say it's a rich, it's a rich language. You know, and it really is. It's like a rich and really beautiful language that has so many, it's so expressive. And even just being able to speak English well is really an incredible thing.
Well, that's another question, and I'm sorry, hopefully I won't derail you with this. But it seems to me that, like, there's so many facets to literacy. Being able to speak well, being able to listen well,
yeah.
and to take away... complicated stories and language and subtext.
Yeah.
Are these considered part of literacy, or you're
absolutely.
Just dealing? Oh, okay.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is kind of the the big struggle in the literacy world right now is between sort of the two main branches of how to teach reading, if you can be so simplistic. But
what are those two branches?
So the one comes from, I would say it originally comes from whole whole language.
Mm-hmm. And what's that? I'm sorry. I'm gonna, I think I know.
Yeah.
But
so,
it, sorry. So it won't hurt to hear.
Yeah, no,
again.
Absolutely. Whole language and its various relations are basically trying to look at reading not through a sound to symbol relationship. So reading.
It's using, like Chinese.
Using pictures, yeah. Like using looking at the words is almost like pictures or images.
And I was thinking, here's this guy that has meant so much to me and has been such an inspiration to me in all kinds of ways, you know, musically, sartorially, just sort of as a person in the world.
Take your Wellingtons off, children, and Mammy will tell you a pleasant story.
Good evening, Kevin Factor here. Delayed start with tonight's program at Foraging Ahead. Tonight I have an interview with Franz Nicolay, one of my favorite guests. He wrote a marvelous essay called The Old Man and the Keys in honor of Garth Hudson. And that's who we're going to be talking about and honoring tonight. Garth Hudson and the band. The article itself is brilliant. It's at theringer.com. It's called The Old Man and the Keys. Franz is an author of several books. He's a professional musician. He's a great neighbor. And he is one of the most knowledgeable people I know. He speaks in whole paragraphs and often sends me running for a dictionary. We're going to talk about his love of Garth Hudson and the inspiration that Garth Hudson provided for him as a young musician, both musically and sartorially.
Yeah, there was a story that was making the rounds a few years ago when he first went to the nursing home that he had that inspired people to start writing letters. And I wrote him a letter. And I think, you know, hundreds of people did from around the world, just saying, like, here's what you meant to us. And I was in a COVID quarantine, so I had 10 days in a room by myself, and I was trying to think how to make it productive. And I was thinking, here's this guy that has meant so much to me and has been such an inspiration to me in all kinds of ways, you know, musically, sartorially, just sort of as a person in the world. And let me take this time to really think about what that legacy is in some detail. And I didn't know whether I was going to, you know, save it for a time like this or sort of, you know, I also believe in letting people know what they mean to you while they're still around. So I thought, wasn't sure whether I was going to try to publish it then or now. I ended up feeling like, okay, I wrote him this personal letter. I'll save this to talk about, you know, after he's gone, what the totality of his life and career meant. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you don't always have that kind of time. It was sort of a gift to have that kind of time to just spend meditating on someone who's meant a lot to you. Mm-hmm.
And what did he mean? What did he mean to you? Like, when did you first hear the band and you like, oh, what's this guy doing?
You know, I was a Dylan fanatic in high school, and so that was the entry point. And then the Basement Tapes specifically, I think, you know, me and a lot of people, especially in this part of the world. But I would stare at that album cover. Mm. That's sort of where there, you know, there's French horns and tubas and accordions. And it's sort of, there was something about it that gave me, I felt like that and the sound of the thing, which was so mysterious. And it gave me permission to if it felt like to pick up the accordion that my dad had sitting around the house and start thinking about, like, what can I do with this?
And
mandolins.
How old are you?
I'm 15, 16 years
old.
Yeah,
that's the age.
You know, so all thinking outside the canonic rock instruments, you know, I had gotten an electric guitar. I was already a piano player. But, oh, what about accordions? What about mandolins? What about, you know, horns? And also, just in terms of, you know, there's those canonic Elliot Landy photos of the band in the sort of sepia tone, mountain man outfits, but also the costumes they're in on the cover of the Basement Tapes. I started thinking about performance and costume and, you know, how can you present yourself, the way that rock bands were presenting themselves on stage in the 1990s was so opposite of that. Mm. You know, the whole aesthetic was to pretend that you're not performing, sort of stumble on stage in your street clothes. And this appealed to me as quite the opposite of that, because it already seemed to me that to get on stage meant putting on some kind of show, meant putting on some kind of persona, even if that persona was acting like you didn't have a persona.
Right.
And so for me, it was a little more comfortable to think about it as I'm going to put on a suit and tie, or I'm going to put on one of these carnivalesque outfits, and then it's quite clear the distinction between the offstage and onstage.
Yeah. Ironically, it's more honest.
I do think it's more honest, and I thought that at the time, and also I thought, you know, outfits like this, you can age in them in a way that you can't in more traditional rock and roll outfits. You know, if I wear a suit and a hat on stage when I'm 22. I can still be wearing a suit and a hat on stage when I'm 47 and 80, you know? And so a lot of music that teenagers get interested in, it involves not just the music, but a whole identity package.
Yeah, absolutely.
That you can take on. And then the stuff that really interested me about the band, once I started going down that rabbit hole, you know, obviously it's the vocal harmonies.
Mm-hmm.
It's the lack of an identifiable front person. But it's also the role of the keyboards in the band.
They had two. They had
two keyboards.
Richard Manuel and Garth Hudson.
Yes, that piano-organ combination that they sourced essentially from gospel music. Mm-hmm. And becomes incredibly influential, right? So think about the E Street Band with Roy Bittan on piano and Danny Federici on organ and accordion, I have to think is directly inspired by the band. Ben Montench does a similar thing with two hands with Petty and the Heartbreakers. But, you know, very particularly the really adventurous musical things that Hudson himself is doing. You know, he talked about the two roles as one of the things that concerned him when they asked him to join the band, in addition to sort of their roistering lifestyle, which wasn't exactly his personality, was that he didn't think he had a heavy enough left hand, you know.
What do you mean by heavy?
So from a piano playing point of view, the early rock and roll pianists, Fats Domino, Jerry Lee Lewis, Little Richard, it's really heavy octaves or maybe tenths in the left hand, and then busy in the right hand. And Hudson, who had been trained as a classical pianist, didn't have that sort of heavy rhythmic left hand. He had the more versatile melodic left hand that you get from studying Bach, right? Where you can, the idea is that you can be equally versatile in both hands. But they had Richard Manuel, who did come up on that sort of R&B style of piano playing. And so Manuel considered himself, you could think of them as rhythm guitar and lead guitar. Right? Manuel is the rhythm player and Hudson is the lead player.
I pulled into Nazareth, was feeling about half-past dead. I just need some place where I can lay my head. Hey, mister, can you tell me where a man might find a bed? He just grinned and shook my hand. No was all he said.
do you feel that without Hudson that the band would not have achieved that level of success or acclaim?
They talk about how he took them from being a pretty good bar band, essentially a rockabilly band. And when he came in, the fact that he played, when he joined the Toronto bar scene, he was primarily a saxophone player. He was really interested in these R&B sax players from the late 40s and early 50s. And so he brought in addition, he brought a lot of things to the table for a young band. He brought, all of a sudden they could be more soulful because if they could have a horn section, they could move from rockabilly into more R&B. He brought his technical ability as a keyboardist, which takes them to a different place. Takes them, and the fact that he's playing organ brings them to a much more gospel place than the more country rockabilly thing they had been doing. But also his, you know, one of the famous stories about him joining the band is his parents were skeptical, and the way that the band leader was able to talk them into letting him go on the road with them was saying, "Oh, we're going to give him $10 a week to give us music lessons." Now, that was a little bit of a cover story, right?
Right.
They weren't sitting down and taking music lessons. But what he did have was a harmonic knowledge, and he could expand the harmonic palette of the band, especially once they started writing their own material and were looking to be a little more ambitious harmonically than, you know, 3 or 4 chord blues, early rockabilly type stuff. And so Robbie Robertson talks about, you know, he would be searching for a chord that was a little outside of their language, and Garth would be able to show him what it is. Or like, "Sounds like you're going for this. Oh yeah, that is what I was going for." You know, and sort of nudge them out of their comfort zone in terms of what they had at their fingertips. And then, you know, in terms of their original music, right? So for the first decade of their career, they're a support band. They're supporting Ronnie Hawkins. They do a little bit of touring on their own, but they're playing covers. Mm-hmm. And then with Bob Dylan, famously, and so it's pretty well into their career before they start putting out records of original material. You know,
and that started in Woodstock.
In Woodstock.
In Woodstock, they started writing their own music.
Yeah, I mean, they had written a few songs early in their career. There's some, you know, 45s you can find on YouTube, but you know, it's music from Big Pink. It's the Basement Tapes, and then music from Big Pink, where they really start exploring songwriting, particularly Robbie Robertson, but to some extent Richard Manuel. And Robbie is particularly interested in, and this has been sort of hashed out in all kinds of in publications and criticism about them, but he's really interested, as a Canadian, is really interested in that Southern American experience. And so a lot of the material is coming from stories that Levon, who grew up in Arkansas, is telling him. And so that's bringing some of that Southern hillbilly redneck quality to it. But what I think Hudson brings to the table is this other sonic detritus of pre-rock American ethnic whiteness, let's say. Or just whiteness in general.
So
the Scotch-Irish Appalachian stuff, the Acadian and then Cajun stuff, so the French-speaking Canadians who then moved down to Louisiana. The Anglican hymns. He played, one of his early professional experience was playing the organ at his uncle's funeral parlor.
So
he has all these hymns at his fingertips. When you talk about church music coming into rock and roll, it's almost always the gospel tradition, the African American,
or even the white.
But what he's bringing, and to talk specifically about the organ aspect of it, the Hammond organ, right, which is the house organ of gospel music,
which he eschewed.
He didn't want to play the Hammonds. Yeah, he wanted this very specific Lowry Festival organ that he had worked as a, I think he worked as a salesman for an organ company, for the Estee Organ Company when he was a teenager. And so he would go to these organ trade festivals and try them all out. And he decided this particular organ was the one he wanted. And so part of the deal when he joined the band is that they would buy him one of these. They had to save up for 6 months to get him this Lowry Festival organ. They drove across the border to Detroit and got it. And then that was the deal.
That's funny. Very Flannery O'Connor.
Yeah.
Right.
But so to also distance himself from the Hammond organ, which then as now is the hegemonic organ in rock and roll, is also setting a little distance between himself and that black gospel tradition. And one of the, because one of the things he liked about the Lowry is it has this quality of a pump organ, of that sort of Victorian parlor organ. The other thing he liked about it was that it had a little lever down by his knee that had a that you could bend the pitch with. And so you could, it was a way to work around, and you can hear this in some of his improvisations with the band, is that he has a pitch bend quality in a way that guitarists have always had and horn players have always had, but keyboard players are usually structurally excluded from, because you can't bend a key. But the Lowry had a built-in knee lever that would drop the pitch half a step, and then he modified it so it would drop, could drop it a whole step.
Wow. So, also in the article, you talk about the sort of the phases of the band. Yeah. Like, as you said, some of the mythology behind the band is that they were wholly democratic because they didn't have a front man or a lead. And you're like, eh, that's not really true. But, and that also that they were at their best consistently when they were backing up somebody else.
That is one of the contemporary criticisms you would hear about, you can read about them at the time, is that once they started touring by themselves, because there wasn't a front man to be the magnet of attention, that they could be a little bit inward looking at each other, that there wasn't anyone to engage the audience. And Hudson occasionally in interviews seems like to support that impression. He did feel like that they were best when they were backing up another singer. You know, and he's someone also that, you know, I recently wrote this book called Band People, which is about support musicians, the musicians who aren't the sort of irreplaceable, but not necessarily the front people. And he is really my platonic ideal. Like, he's the ultimate band person, you know, because he's bringing so much to the table in terms of his technique and sophistication and multi-instrumentalism, but was apparently entirely egoless, you know, barely put out records under his own name.
Which is amazing for a rock and roll musician, especially, like, I think some of the titanic ego of Robbie Robertson. And
but without Hudson, the band doesn't become the band in the way that you think about him. So you have these sort of nesting dolls of support identity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Garth Hudson, the ultimate support musician, the band, the ultimate backing band.
Where do they peak, and like, how did they fall apart to the point that they did?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I'll have any contrary takes on the conventional wisdom.
Well, I'm all for conventional wisdom.
You know, there's a way in which they came full circle, right, from being a jobbing bar band in Toronto and then sort of driving around in a station wagon playing covers, to in the 50s and early 60s, to returning to that in the 80s and 90s, to being, you know, a jobbing bar band, schlepping around playing these weird kind of crappy gigs, playing covers. You know, the really active and creative period of the band is a relatively short one, you know, in the course of, you know, 40 years that core group played together in various ways. It's when they settle down in Woodstock and get interested in writing songs, have a short flurry of really great songs on the first two records, and then diminishing returns after that.
Yeah,
you know, it speaks a little bit to and that happens for a lot of bands, right? A lot of bands only have a few good years because chemistry is fleeting. That period of time was particularly productive for them because they were protected, right? Part of the history of the band is that at least three of them is that they got pretty strung out. Some of them worse than others, and that's going to be worse on these huge rock tours, obviously, for all kinds of reasons. But the idea that they were, you know, and it's not that they weren't partying in Woodstock, but they were in a little bit of a bubble, and they had a comfortable domestic situation. And you know, they couldn't get in. So they had a little bit of that time and breathing space to do creative work, right? And they also have, you know, Robbie Robertson, for all that people say about him, you know, this critique of the band that they didn't have a front person or they didn't have a driving force. Mm-hmm. You know, the argument for Robbie Robertson in the 70s is that he's the one pushing them forward, and that everyone else is distracted by chemicals and women and whatever else, and that he's the one who gets who has the energy and the savvy, you know, is able to talk to the record company people and fill out the paperwork, but also has the sort of curious creative mind to say, you know. During the period of time where he was a young guitar player in a bar band, he's really interested in learning how to be a great guitar player. And then during the period of time where he's, you know, spending a lot of time with Bob Dylan, he gets really interested in becoming a songwriter and write some amazing songs. And then when they move out to California and he befriends Martin Scorsese, he gets really interested in movies. And then, you know, isn't interested in writing songs anymore, is interested in getting involved in movies as a producer, as an actor, as a, you know, soundtrack guy. And so you have this very curious, talented, energetic, savvy, ambitious person who's able to sort of put them on his shoulder.
Right.
or to, you know, he's writing these songs, and to some extent Richard Manuel's writing songs, but he's writing songs and he has this incredible machine at his disposal to realize those songs. And so I think to the extent that that's their peak, it's because they had the one person in the group who had the curiosity and the ambition to try to write songs and turned out to be pretty decent at it. They caught him at the right time, and they were insulated enough in Woodstock to not be distracted, and, you know, to all be focused on the one project without a lot of outside pressure and you know giant tour infrastructure and all the other things. You know, you look at their set lists for the rest of the 70s. They're primarily playing songs from those first two records. Like, the set lists stay quite static for, you know, 1973 on.
Right, right. And then
you don't get the impression they're going into the rehearsal room and working up a lot of new material.
No, they were like,
everyone's doing their own thing once they get rich.
Right, right. Is that, well, that's not uncommon.
Not uncommon at all, no.
Not uncommon.
Well, the bands that stay creatively robust over an extended period of time have to find ways to move past that, right? A lot of bands that get big have a great first couple records and five really insane years in them. And then if you want to have a second chapter and a third chapter, you have to be able to get everyone in the room sober to have a serious talk about what the next step is.
Yeah, and what are some bands off the top of your head that you can think have managed to pull that off?
I mean, the ones that jump to mind are bands like REM and U2 and Radiohead. On that very high level, right?
Right.
Not for nothing, those are also bands that agreed very early on that they would share all their songwriting equally, and so they didn't have that, as the band did, those crises around songwriting royalties and publishing and about who gets credit for the songs and the extra income stream. So those are bands that all got rich together at the same time. And, you know, not for nothing, don't have that history of acrimony. And part of that is because Peter Buck from REM was a dedicated reader of band biographies, and he identified that very early as, like, this is an obvious pitfall and a stumbling block for bands, that they, you know, one person gets way rich, or two people get way richer because they have the songwriting credits. Let's just, before there's any money at stake, just say everyone, we're going to split it equally, and then we can avoid that, which is pretty smart, you know, but that's the sort of thing that only a second or third generation rocker has the perspective on the mistakes that earlier generations have made. Who's done his homework. I mean, the canonic examples of artists that reinvent themselves musically periodically tend not to be bands, right? They tend to be Bob Dylan, David Bowie. You know, solo acts can fire a band and hire a whole new crew of people if they want to reinvent themselves musically. Whereas band chemistry, both personal and creative, can have some guardrails around it, you know, because if everyone has a more or less equal creative say, and that's not always the case, but if the Venn diagram of four or five people's taste is going to intersect over a relatively limited sonic signature, and so everybody really has to be on board if you want to get them to move outside of that place where their tastes naturally overlap.
just highlight Garth Hudson.
Yeah.
The first genetic method, which I've never heard. What is the genetic
method? Genetic method was, they would give him a few minutes to improvise by himself as an introduction to Chest Fever.
Okay.
The song Chest Fever in their live shows. And they didn't call it anything. It was just like Garth's time to jam. They on the Rock of Ages live record, they called it the genetic method because Garth was reading an ethnomusicological text at the time that was called the genetic method. There's one on the Watkins Glen live record. They call it Too Wet to Work because it was a thunderstorm and he just went out on stage and started improvising. But it's just the Garth improvisation. And it lets him explore the kinds of music that he was interested. So those, the hymn songs, the Bach, the fiddle tunes and accordion tunes that he was interested in. And this is sort of, if you went to see Garth Hudson in the last couple decades, this is what you would get. Mm-hmm. You would get up on stage at a piano or at a couple different keyboards and just improvise in this free associative way. And sometimes you can see taped interviews where it seems like he prefers to do that than even to talk
right.
to an interviewer.
Interesting.
I've seen where it's a little easier for him to just communicate what he needs if he's got a piano in front of him and able to sort of free associate in that way. So I picked this just because that's the first recorded example.
Yeah, you said he was interested in synesthesia as well.
He was a curious tinkerer.
Yeah.
He comes out of this... I compare him in the piece to Charles Ives because he comes out of this 19th century American imaginary of, brass bands and tinkerers. And so he built a pipe organ in his garage. He, hooked up... a telegraph key to an instrument for a particular effect. He would mold his own bullets once he lived up in Glenford and got into guns and knives. He would sort of mold his own bullets. And Yamaha, he was a consultant for Yamaha keyboards in the 80s. He modded up his organs all the time. He was curious about different forms of musical expression. He was curious about synesthesia. He got really into, it sounds like, norteño music and polka. He and his wife would tape the SUNY Newport's college radio show had a polka and norteño show that he would tape and listen to.
How did he wind up in Kingston or upstate? They went out to California, I guess Malibu or something like that, and they lived the California rock and roll lifestyle.
Yeah, he had a ranch in Malibu. He just liked it back in the Catskills. There was a fire. His Malibu ranch burned. The band had broken up. Levon gravitated back here.
And did he and Levon maintain a relationship?
Yeah, basically all of the other guys except Robbie. Within a couple of years, we're back after the Last Waltz, we're back touring as the band. their position basically was that they never wanted to stop.
They just liked playing music.
Like playing music together. All they knew how to do since they were teenagers.
Yeah, which is great.
But yeah, Garth, really embraced, I think, for some of the others, that the sort of hillbilly dress up was a little bit of a pose, but he really seemed to embrace it and, was plowing his driveway and skinning roadkill and making his own bullets. And yeah, he and his wife got a place up in Glenford, I think up by the reservoir, and they were there for the last, I don't know. Years.
Oh, wow.
When I get on.
Mexico, the Lake Charles, Louisiana, little Bessie girl I once knew. And she told me just to come on by if there's anything that she could do. Up on Cripple Creek, she sends me if I spring a leak. She mends me, I don't have to speak, and she defends me a drunkard's dream if I ever did. Stung me to the base track, I did go. She bet on one horse to win, and I bet on another to show. The odds were in my favor, I had them 5-1. And that nag to win came around the track, sure enough, we had won. Up on Cripple Creek, and she sends me in my spring.
Good with money. Not one of those guys.
Not much. There's a lot of guys.
Yeah, the storage. There was a storage space got robbed, and then there was another one that got auctioned off because he hadn't paid the rent in a while. But then the reports were there was a $26,000 royalty check among the things in the storage space that he had never cashed. That sort of absent-minded professor stuff.
Uh-huh. No, it seems classic.
I mean, it's such a common story. I mean, even if there's not nefariousness going on, at a certain level, there's a machine. You have so many people working for you. You become responsible to the staff. You know, I'm sure that was an issue for the Grateful Dead. Oh. You know, I know Metallica has talked about that. It's you have to play a certain number of shows just to meet payroll, essentially.
You're an industry.
You feel a responsibility. You don't want to lay these people off. They work for you. Mm. You know, there's an aspect. You know, Mike Campbell from the Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers tours now as Mike Campbell and the Dirty Knobs, and to some extent, I think he likes going out and playing, but he's a multimillionaire Rock and Roll Hall of Famer. He doesn't have to. I think there's not a small part of it that is a make-work program for the old Tom Petty crew, you know, who have been working for them since the 70s and had never known another employer.
Right.
And he's like, well, let's just go book me some theaters and we can keep the guitar tech on the job until he wants to retire, basically.
Well, that's decent.
Yeah, that's very decent guy.
Very decent.
I think he also likes playing. There is also that.
So, the genetic method, and Every Time I See the Sun.
So Every Time I See the Sun is a late career version of the same thing. Mm-hmm. So Garth, you know, like I said, he barely put out records under his own name. There is one record under his own name called To the Sea, something to the Sea.
It's in the article.
It's in the article, yeah. It's sort of jammy. He covers Dark Star.
The Grateful Dead.
Yeah. there was
a
soundtrack that he did for an art installation in Los Angeles that included, I think, a voiceover by Ray Bradbury. And then there's my favorite is it's a live record. It's called Live at the Wolf. It's him and his wife. It's credited to Garth and Maude Hudson. And that's, I think, the most accurate representation of what you would get if you hired Garth Hudson to come play your festival. Mm-hmm. You know, it's some covers. She sings a little bit. They do Willow Weep for Me. They do, you know, some band covers.
Does he sing?
He doesn't sing, no. He appears on as a doing a recitation on one like very deep cut Basement Tapes outtake. No, he doesn't sing. He talks about in his youth that he, you know, when he was like a 16 or 17 year old rock and roller, he got up and sang, and that the crowd looking at him, their expectations were too overwhelming, and that he didn't want to put himself in that position again. Oh. The Every Time I See the Sun is him doing that kind of improvisation on a piano. You know, to contextualize it a little bit, it's not that far off from Keith Jarrett records. Hmm. And I think has a certain, that combination of harmonic simplicity and harmonic sophistication.
Rag Mama Rag.
Rag Mama Rag is a classic band track record. And either the studio version or the live version on Rock of Ages, that's Garth playing piano, which he doesn't usually do in the band. Usually it's Manuel playing the piano and Garth playing the organ or later on synthesizers. Mm. Like, there's a lot of synthesizers on the last couple band records. But he plays I believe I'm right in saying that on Rag Mama Rag, on the studio version, Manuel is playing drums and Garth is playing piano. And you can immediately tell the difference when it's Garth on piano. Because it's also Garth on piano in The Wait. He's playing those octave fills that will be so familiar to everybody. It just becomes much more, you know, I think Manuel's description of himself as a rhythm player is right. You know, but if you get Garth on piano, it's going to become much more chaotic and much more. You know, Rag Mama Rag is much more virtuosic, much more chromatic, right? Like all those fills on The Wait are these like octave chromatic things that you would never hear Manuel do. Rag Mama Rag is essentially Barrel House piano with all the spokes flying off. It's modernist Barrel House piano.
Did you do? I crawled up to the railroad track like a fool. poison in my sleeping bag. But all you wanna do for me, mama, is bang, mama, bang. And nowhere to go.
Everybody classic, will yeah. know up on Cripple Creek. And the driver of that song is, you know, one of the most recognizable parts of that song is this clavinet through the wah that Hudson is playing.
It sounds like a jew harp.
Yes, and that was sort of what he was going for.
A mouth harp for...
Jaws harp,
Jaws harp.
And if you see, you know, you can see videos of them performing it. It's a single note thing, but he does this funny thing with his, and he's playing it with his left hand. He does this funny thing where he's alternating, and this is a classical technique under certain circumstances, where he's alternating the finger, which finger he's playing that single note with. But the reason that I wanted to highlight this is because this becomes really important in American rock and pop history, because he's the first person to run the clavinet through the wah, which becomes a core sound in 70s funk, because Stevie Wonder hears this and decides he wants to try it. And then you get Superstition, and then that becomes the clavinet through the wah becomes like a funk sound.
Interesting.
But this was, you know, Garth Hudson.
Stevie Wonder got that from hearing this.
That's my understanding, yeah. And so, the sound of 70s funk,
ironically,
comes from Garth Hudson trying to imitate a jazz harp with a clavinet.
Mm-hmm.